Support for NPR podcasts comes from Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD.
From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. It's just 48 hours after Turkey Day, so if you're still in a tryptophan haze, stay tuned. Ahead on Only a Game, a jolt of football adrenaline via updates of the highly unusual college and pro gridiron seasons, and the story of NFL stars who help fund education for low-income city kids by trading their pads for flags. Also ahead, preparations are underway for the first Soccer World Cup on the African continent, but skeptics wonder whether the event will help many South Africans.
I think there is a danger of placing too much expectation on 2010, and it's certainly not going to be a magic wand that'll make all the problems disappear. The shacks will still be here on 2010. You won't make them go away.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Raiders, 2-8, all probably wish they'd stayed in bed. The Falcons are near flightless, and the Dolphins, heck, they're dead. St. Louis has rammed next to no one. San Francisco's bad. So far, this prologue strikes me as five levels south of sad. So let's reverse our field and try to have a little fun by talking of some teams that have gone out most weeks and won. Here to help me with that discussion is Mike Reese, who covers the NFL for the Boston Globe. Mike, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on.
Since about September 9th, New England fans and media have been making comparisons between the Patriots and the historically great National Football League teams. Is it time now to start considering this year's Pats as perhaps one of the best ever?
Well, I certainly think so, although when you mention that around the team here to head coach Bill Belichick and the players, they're quick to remind you that it's only been 10 games, and 10 games does not make a season. But when you look at what they've done to this point in the year, they're not just winning games, they are convincingly winning games. And as we saw up in Buffalo on last Sunday night, 56-10, the margins of victory are only growing.
The Pats are 10-0, as you say. The Dolphins are 0-10. Will the remaining members of the 16-0, 72 Dolphins spontaneously combust if the Pats run the table in the regular season and go on to win the Super Bowl while the Dolphins go an unprecedented 0-16?
I think that's exactly what's going to happen. It seems like every year those members of that undefeated Dolphins team back in 72 take great joy when the final team goes down. And I think there's been some added fuel to the fire this year for the Patriots when, of course, we remember Don Shula said something earlier this year that maybe there should be a mark on the Patriots' record should they indeed go undefeated. And I can tell you those remarks were heard here up in New England.
The Super Bowl champion Colts regained their composure on Thursday after losing twice this season and then barely getting by a bad Kansas City team last weekend. Will they continue to regain their 2006 form?
You know, I think they will, and I think it's a good reminder that last year at this time, that was a team that was still trying to find its identity, and really they made a late push to their Super Bowl championship. I think it would be a big mistake to count out the Indianapolis Colts. They have just had a very tough stretch. I believe it was about six games in 32 days or so. I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but right around there, and that is a very difficult stretch. They've had a lot of injuries, but they're still sitting right there at 9 wins, 2 losses, and of all the teams that have played the Patriots this season, which the Patriots, I think we all agree, are the best team in the league, I don't think anyone has played them tougher than the Indianapolis Colts.
The Green Bay Packers are 10-1 after beating the Lions on Thursday. What's in the water in Green Bay?
It's an unbelievable story. To me, probably the best story of the league this year, because I remember listening to the quarterback, Brett Favre, you know, before the season, basically lamenting the fact that the Packers didn't go out and trade for Randy Moss, who ended up in New England. And now you look at him, and it's opened the door for some younger players, and Brett Favre has turned back the clock. He's playing like he did back when he was a youngster coming into the league. So a great story, and of course we know probably the greatest fans in the NFL, so it's well-deserved for the people up in Green Bay.
Favre's played well enough so that he's talking about playing for another year.
Oh, and he should. And I'll tell you, it's just as recently as a couple of years ago, people were saying it's time to hang it up. And to me, that's just one of the great parts about the NFL, because you never know. And even Favre himself said it at the start of the season. He really had no idea which way this year would go. So the Packers, a great surprise story.
The Dallas Cowboys are 10-1, and they face Green Bay on Thursday, and the pundits say the NFC is irrelevant.
I disagree. If you look at the numbers, the NFC is actually beating the AFC in games in which the two conferences play each other, and it has been 11 years, I believe, and maybe even longer, since the NFC has actually topped the AFC in interconference games. So I think the NFC is really closing the gap here, as those numbers suggest.
We have talked about four very good teams in the NFL. Are there only four? Is parity out the window this year?
Oh, parity is out the window. I think that's clear based on some of the really, really bad football we've seen this year. I think on Thanksgiving Day we saw one of those games where it was a 34-3 victory, the Cowboys over the Jets. So a lot of bad football, although I would say there's more than four good teams. A team like the Jacksonville Jaguars has sort of quietly put together a nice season at 7 wins and 3 losses. So, you know, a team like that is one that you can't overlook. And even a team like the Cleveland Browns, which, you know, you wouldn't put them in the same category as the Green Bay Packers, but certainly a surprise team at 6 wins and 4 losses. And keep an eye on the Detroit Lions, even though they've struggled a little bit with 3 losses in a row, they're still at 6 wins and 5 losses.
7-3 or 6-4 qualifies a team to be a dark horse in a year like this, I guess.
Yeah, and the question, of course, is does that even matter? Because the teams at the top, as you mentioned, and specifically the New England Patriots, just seem to be at such a higher level than these other teams around the league.
Mike Rees covers the NFL for the Boston Globe. Mike, thank you very much for speaking with me.
And thanks for having me.
Earlier this month, the New England Patriots opened the gates at Gillette Stadium for the first annual Bell Bowl, a flag football tournament for 12 teams coached by former and current Patriots players. The teams represent corporations that have donated hundreds of thousands of dollars to the nonprofit organization Bell. Only a Game's Milena Spitzer was there, and she has this report.
Tonight seems like any game night at Gillette Stadium. The bright lights are shining and fans are decked out in red, white, and blue gear. But it's a Tuesday night, and instead of filing into the bleachers, fans are pouring onto the field where 12 teams of amateur players in brightly colored jerseys are warming up. I enter the stadium under a giant inflatable helmet archway and am greeted by Sean Thomas, an enthusiastic 10-year-old in an oversized Patriots jacket. Like most of the other children here, he has one thing on his mind.
Meeting the Patriots, getting my own football signed by the Patriots.
Who would you like to sign it?
Everyone on the team. There's no particular person, just everyone.
While not everyone on the team will be making an appearance, 5 current Patriots, including Teddy Bruschi, Vince Wilfork, and Jarvis Green, are coaching flag football teams tonight. They're joined by 7 retired Patriots, including former greats Steve Grogan, Andre Tippett, and Roland James. For Sean, only one important player seems to be missing.
Moss. I don't know his first name, though.
Randy Moss?
Yes, I don't know why, but he's my favorite. He's the best to me. He's perfect for the team. I hope they don't trade him at all. Never, ever, ever.
They call Sean a Bell Scholar, a title designed to inspire confidence in elementary school students who attend Bell's summer and after-school education programs. Bell, which stands for Building Educated Leaders for Life, was founded by a group of Black and Latino Harvard Law students in 1992 and has grown to educate 12,000 children each year in underprivileged communities across the U.S. I caught up with Bell's co-founder and CEO, Earl Martin Phelan, before the event at Bell's headquarters in Boston's Dorchester neighborhood.
The great thing about the Bell Bowl is that 100% of the proceeds are going to go to fund summer scholarships for children. So for every $1,000, we get to serve another child in a high-quality, six-week, all-day summer learning program that includes academics and enrichment.
With the $400,000 in corporate donations brought in by the event, Bell will be able to enroll 400 new students in their programs this summer. And without the scholarship, Phelan says the cost of the program would be prohibitive for most Bell scholars, whose average family income last year was $16,038 for a family of three. The financial barriers that Bell scholars face hit close to home for New England Patriots nose tackle Vince Wilfork. Back at Gillette Stadium, he tells a group of Bell scholars why he decided to come out for the bowl.
I have two kids of my own. Growing up in a poor home, I didn't have the opportunity that you guys have in right now. I want you guys to, you know, see what it feels like to be in college, to grow up and be successful. So anything you put your mind to, you're going to do it. I don't care what anyone tell you. Trust your dream.
I follow Wilfork over to a huddle with his team from Fidelity Investments, the lead sponsor of the event.
You're going for two. Oh, just stay in there. You're going for two. We're going for two. They can't score on us. Hey, we're going on two.
As the flag football game heats up, it's clear that Wilfork has high expectations for his less than professional team.
Right now, we're leaving a lot of points on the field. There it is. That's it. We're leaving a lot of points on the field. We should be up 28-0 by now, but we're only up 6-0 right now. But you know what? We got to get it together.
The game ends with Fidelity F Troop moving on to the next round after an 8-0 lead over Team Target. Across the stadium, former quarterback Steve Grogan, the Patriots' all-time career passing leader, is busy coaching Team Boulder Capital. He says this isn't like most other events he's asked to attend.
As a former player, you get invited to a lot of different fundraising events, and usually you got to put a coat and tie on and go schmooze with people, and this just sounded like fun to me. I mean, it's a great, great cause, a great event. It's around football. You get to come out in your jeans and tennis shoes. It's a fun thing to be at.
And how's your team doing tonight?
My team is struggling. We lost our first game. Their spirits are high, and they had a couple beers during the intermission, and I think they're going to play better in the second game.
High spirits aren't enough to keep Grogan's team in the running. Boulder Capital loses to Fidelity in the second round. But in round three, Fidelity succumbs to Castanea Partners, who go on to win the Bell Bowl Championship Trophy in a 13-6 win over, you guessed it, the Patriots. Unfortunately for Castanea, it isn't a win against the real New England Patriots, just the organization's front office team. After the games are finished, I head over for my last interview of the night, the youngest ever Patriots cheerleader recruit.
Oh, this is our newest representative. Her name is Destiny.
I'm four.
She's four. Destiny, show her what we taught you today with the palms.
Destiny pushes the pom-poms energetically in the air as if she's been practicing since she was a baby. And in a way, she has. She's been cheering on her father, Vince Wilfork, since she was big enough to attend his games. I asked her about the coolest thing her dad's ever done.
Made it. Made a touchdown.
He made a touchdown?
Yep. Make it.
Vince Wilfork has never scored a touchdown during his four-year career in the NFL. But on a night when fans, Patriots, and children play together on the turf at Gillette Stadium, even a touchdown by a 325-pound nose tackle seems possible. For Only a Game, I'm Milena Spitzer in Foxborough, Massachusetts.
I'm going to start by everyone! Touchdown! I'm going to start by everyone!
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Fans of sumo wrestling are eagerly anticipating the return of sumo grand champion Asa Shoru to competition. The 27-year-old from Mongolia was banned from tournaments in August for playing in a charity soccer match at a time when he claimed his injuries were preventing him from wrestling. The fans are certainly no happier than Asa Shoru himself, who, according to authorities in Japan, fell into melancholy after his suspension, a development that encouraged sumo officials to reinstate the champion earlier than they had planned. There is no truth to the rumor that Barry Bonds is planning to fall into melancholy or play soccer if the U.S. government keeps bothering him. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game of Shin Guards and Shantytowns. South Africa prepares for the 2010 World Cup, but first, a most irregular college football regular season is winding down. Here to talk upsets, bowl bids, and border wars is Yahoo Sports columnist Dan Wetzel. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill, thank you.
Number 2 Kansas hosts number 4 Missouri today. That game will determine which team goes to the Big 12 championship game and enjoys the inside track to the national championship game. It's a fine rivalry even when these teams aren't so highly ranked, but this is the biggest game in the history of either program, right?
By far the biggest game in Kansas history, and pretty much certainly probably the biggest in Missouri history. They've had a little better history, but not much. Usually this is one of your just classic games this time of year between two rival schools. They're playing it this year in Kansas City, which is obviously both in Missouri and in Kansas, so it's kind of the central point. And, they're usually one of those kind of blood rivalry games. But now it's going to be even bigger, national title implications. Whoever wins this game stays in the running for the national championship. They would go to the Big 12 championship and probably play Oklahoma for a chance to keep going. So huge stakes for two teams that normally have nothing at stake.
In keeping with the spirit of the season of upsets, number 1 LSU lost at home to Arkansas on Friday. What does this do to the overall bowl picture?
Well, it continues to blow it up completely. It's just been one of those years. LSU had that inside track, and now that's gone. What it really does is open up just so much hope. West Virginia has clearly got a big-time chance. Whoever comes out of this trio from the Big 12, really down to two, between Missouri and Kansas is going to get in. You're going to see a team like Ohio State make their case, even though they're not playing anymore. Any team with one loss has got a chance at sneaking into that title game, and that's really the big thing. And it just continues what's been an absolutely wild season that basically says, I don't know if we're going to have a champion this year. I mean, someone is going to win it. Someone's going to hold the little ball up, but I don't know if any of them you're going to sit there and go, yep, that was the team this year.
USC dismantled Arizona State by a score of 44-24 on Thursday. With Oregon out of the picture, who will join USC in the Rose Bowl?
Well, most likely it's going to be Ohio State, unless they somehow the seas part and they can move into the BCS championship game. Ohio State hasn't been in a long time. They're the traditional champion of the Big Ten. So they'll be the favored shot, but the Buckeyes still have an outside shot in a year like this with so many upsets that they can snake their way back into the title game.
West Virginia is back and has a real shot to make the title game. What do they have to do to get there?
Well, it'd be UConn, and then they have to be Pitt in the backyard war. Another one of these classic games this time of year. West Virginia's been really patient. They struggled. They lost one game early to South Florida. And they've pretty much rolled everybody since. They have a great quarterback. They've kind of bid their time while everybody else has lost, and the pack has come back to them. So huge deal for West Virginia because this is a season they built to, and obviously it's a state that focuses almost completely on one sport, and that's West Virginia football. So there's heavy interest in that state. I don't know if there's a state more devoted to their single team than West Virginia. People in West Virginia are to West Virginia football.
Given the nature of your work, Dan, I fear the answer to this next question may be long, but which big games will you be watching today?
Definitely Kansas and Missouri. It's the game of the day because of the title implications. I'm always interested in Auburn and Alabama, the Iron Bowl, as they call it. It's a cultural phenomenon down in Alabama. Just because the only major sports they really have going in the state. Even in a year when neither team is really that great, it's a tremendously vicious game. And it harkens me back to one of the great moments in college, really in all time in multiple sports, was when the Alabama-Auburn game coincided with the first day of deer hunting season back in the 90s. And really was a conundrum like no other for the state of Alabama.
People just didn't know where to go.
Now, I believe on Huntsville Talk Radio, they spent 743 straight hours discussing what to do. And you know, that kind of cultural impact is, you can't fake it.
Lloyd Carr retired as Michigan's head coach this week. He had a pretty good record there, a 121-40 over 13 seasons, including a national championship and 5 Big Ten conference titles. So why is he leaving?
Well, he's tired. You know, it's a lot of work. Lloyd is a
is a rarity in the college sports coaching world, where he actually has interests outside of football. I know this is almost against the rules, but he's actually read books, not just written them, about how great he is. Is well traveled, likes history, museums, things like this. It's completely mind blowing. And he and his wife want to actually spend some time doing it. He's made millions of dollars, and he loves football, loves coaching, but he's been doing it for, you know, better part of three decades, and or over three decades. So he's ready to move on and try some different stuff.
Dan Wetzel is a columnist for Yahoo Sports who joins us from time to time to discuss college football. He is a sport and thankfully not a Yahoo. Dan, thanks again.
Thanks, Bill.
You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, or peruse our archives by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. Tomorrow, representatives of 205 soccer-loving nations will be present in Durban, South Africa for the preliminary FIFA World Cup draw. The draw is the first step in a two-year campaign to winnow the field down to 32 teams for the 2010 World Cup finals. There is, however, one team assured of a spot in the finals, South Africa, the first African nation in history to host the event. The World Cup has already raised the hopes and fears of its citizens. Only a Game's Ken Shulman traveled to South Africa to learn more.
How do I love the World Cup? In the passenger terminal at Johannesburg's Oliver Tambo Airport, a digital display counts the ways, that is, the days, down to the June 2010 kickoff. Soccer stars soar on brightly colored billboards above the highway leading to town. At Soccer City Stadium, swarms of workers wield hammers and torches, while long-necked construction cranes sway in the air above. It's clear South Africa is putting heart, soul, and pocketbook into this effort.
I think we, at one point or another, have to make a bold statement.
Tim Odise is Director of Communications and Marketing for World Cup 2010. His Johannesburg office looks out onto Soccer City. Set between flat-top mounds of mining refuse and the sprawling black townships of Soweto, the nascent 95,000-seat facility is a bold statement. Modise admits spending money on stadiums might seem frivolous, especially when close to half of South Africa's 35 million blacks are unemployed. But stadiums are just a small part of the plan, he argues.
And besides, we are human. You know, it's like saying you cannot write the book, don't focus on literature, because you're not going to get any profits or any returns out of literature. Therefore, focus only on building bridges and so on.
The FIFA Soccer World Cup is the greatest sporting show on earth, but the big top costs a bundle. South Africa will shell out close to $2 billion on stadium construction in nine match cities. Another $57 billion will fund new housing, airport upgrades, roads, high-speed rail links, and communications. South Africa has the money. The only question is whether the World Cup is where it should go.
Vir die Kaap en ook Oos-Kaap. Goed, so dis provinsiaal.
Peter Cronje is spokesperson for the team that's preparing Cape Town for the World Cup.
It is simply the biggest sporting event in the world. It gives massive global exposure, and it gives one the opportunity to use the investment, the energy, and the synergy to create infrastructure and other benefits we would not normally have achieved.
For South Africa's democratic government, the 2010 World Cup sanctions the country's return to the fold of civilized nations. During apartheid, South Africa was banned from international competition. The country's dynamic, largely white business community sees the World Cup as a venue for its new and improved South African brand. For South Africa's black and overwhelmingly poor majority, the World Cup holds the promise of jobs. It's this last promise, says Cronje, that will be hardest to keep.
I think there is a danger of placing just too much expectation on 2010. And it's certainly not going to be a magic wand that'll make all the problems disappear. In fact, we've been quite upfront to say that the shacks will still be here on 2010. You won't make them go away.
Although apartheid was abolished in 1992, there are still two South Africas. Cape Town's Victoria and Alfred Waterfront is one of them, a posh spread of boutique shops and high-end restaurants on the edge of the Atlantic Ocean, with dramatic Table Mountain as backdrop. Local performers provide a shade of authentic African color for the millions of tourists who come here each year. Few, if any, tourists visit Cape Flats, a depressed township just 8 miles inland. This is the second South Africa, an uneven spread of shanties and cinder-black houses. Cape Flats' landmark feature is Athlone Stadium, home field for the Ajax Cape Town Soccer Club. Athlone was supposed to be the city's World Cup venue, but FIFA rejected it, allegedly because it didn't want to show poverty up close and personal to billions of TV viewers. Cape Town's World Cup semifinal will be played at a new stadium under construction at Greenpoint, a scenic seaside area just down the road from the waterfront. Most Cape Flats residents can't even afford to get to Greenpoint, let alone purchase a ticket to a World Cup match. But townships like Cape Flats are South Africa's soccer heartland, where kids still dream of growing up to be Pelé, or Platini, or Ronaldinho. Peter Olegi is a professor of history at Michigan State University and an expert on South African sport. He says the love of soccer in townships is both good and bad.
Because it shows that not so much has changed since the heyday of apartheid. If most kids still want to be sports stars, then how many other doors have been opened in society? There are signs that the World Cup will not do much to address the inequalities bequeathed by nearly half a century of apartheid.
Perhaps the greatest disappointment awaiting South Africans will be their national team. The boys, or Bafana Bafana as they're known in Zulu, are currently ranked 83rd in the world, below Iceland, Armenia, and Oman. But hope still springs eternal, as it does in this bar on the outskirts of Soweto, where Arthur Mombasa and his friends watch their team compete in a friendly match against Scotland. Mombasa holds what he calls a dangerous opinion. He thinks South Africa will win in 2010.
It's dangerous in that how does one sitting on this side of the world, that as a South African team, we can hardly beat Nigeria and we can hardly beat Lesotho, but then we think we can beat the likes of the Brazils and the Italies and the Germanys of this world. However, is there any harm in being optimistic?
There may be. Ralph Hendricks is an elementary school principal and a former soccer star in South Africa's segregated colored league. He now lives in a middle-class Johannesburg neighborhood, once reserved for whites. Hendricks thinks a heaping spoonful of prevention is in order, for the fans and for the country.
Because after the moment of glory, the hangover of the next day is inevitable. Sometimes you have to take a few tablets before you really go into your party. And we're going to have a party in 2010. The world's come to party with us. But when they leave, what then?
South Africa has a solid track record on staging major events. The 1994 general elections, the first after apartheid, were a triumph. Since then, the country has hosted rugby and cricket World Cups. There's little doubt that the 2010 Soccer World Cup will be a success for investors and sponsors and fans of all ages. The real question is, what happens when the circus leaves town? For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman in Johannesburg, South Africa.
You're listening to Only a Game. 2 weeks ago, we featured a story about a curious but long-standing tradition at the University of Pennsylvania, where fans express support of their football team by throwing toast onto the field. The university aids and abets the tradition by supplying an industrial-strength toaster at the stadium. Fans need only bring the bread. Rick Dunphy, a WBUR listener, emailed to say he frowns on the practice. Somehow the thought of Penn football fans wasting 5,000 loaves of bread struck me as shameful, he wrote. Perhaps you, Penn, could think about donating a like amount of loaves to some of Philadelphia's less fortunate communities. Lee Kosin, who hears the show on WRNI in Providence, Rhode Island, agrees and more. Regarding UPenn's tradition, he wrote, "Why not make it really fun and allow the hordes of Philly's homeless and poor to run onto the field, trying to save scraps for a meal?" An email from Bill Kenley, who hears only a game on WFYI in Indianapolis, begins promisingly. "Love the show," he writes. "Your humor and irreverent approach to sports is like a splash of aquavelva." But then he goes on to say, "But that braying jackass Charlie Pierce needs to go. He showed his ignorance by claiming the Pats would beat the Colts by 4 touchdowns. Tell him he was wrong and then give him a carrot." Maybe a couple of carrots. After all, the Pats did win the game. Doug Collier of Rochester, New York, was among those who wrote to correct my pronunciation of the northwestern state between California and Washington. "Henceforth, I will endeavor to say Oregon rather than Oregon." From Hastings, Nebraska, James Lambert emailed to say, "I am not a big sports fan. The only sport I watch is golf, and then only when Tiger Woods is on the course. Only a Game is the only sports show that I enjoy." The way I figure it, that makes Only a Game the Tiger Woods of sports programs. I like that. I like that very much. The Tiger Woods of sports programs. Yes, indeed. Whether you want to discuss the program in similar superlatives, compare our commentators to various four-legged beasts, or otherwise let us know what you think of the show, you can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. You can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org, or you can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This week, the call went out in Beijing for hundreds of tall women to present medals at the Olympic Games, and not just any tall women. "We have some very clear conditions and demands," said Zhao Dongming, the director of the Cultural Activities Department at China's Organizing Committee. "They need to be of a height between 1.68 and 1.78 meters. Their figure should be good." He added that candidates need to have dedicated training and they must have a very clear understanding of the Olympic spirit and the Olympic movement. But some suspect that the authorities would wink at that last business for women who are tall enough to hang medals around the necks of victorious basketball players. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the antithesis of the thrill of defeat. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at this week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
There were three, count them, three NFL games on Thanksgiving. Did you watch each minute of every one of them?
They all stunk, too. That was really bad. The New York Jets, the brief period of optimism after beating Pittsburgh sort of went down the drain against Dallas. I mean, it was intriguing to watch Brett Favre continue his remarkable year. 20 straight completions against the Lions. Green Bay and the Lions is a very old-school Thanksgiving Day game, after all. They should have played it outdoors in a snowstorm. But failing that, it was the only one of the three games that was worth looking up from your cranberry sauce for.
Jerry Jones is best known as owner of the Dallas Cowboys, but now it would seem that he's adding friend of the American television viewer to his bio. Have I got that about right?
Yeah, this whole NFL Network thing, with the NFL Network having its own games, is something that they have not worked any of the kinks out of yet. Not only will the Cowboys and Packers not be available to the entire fan base of either team because it's an NFL Network game, if the New England Patriots go undefeated through the first 15 games of the regular season, their season finale against the New York Giants will also be one of these NFL Network games.
When Carolina hosts New Orleans tomorrow, Vinny Testaverde will start for the Panthers. Is he the Gordie Howe of football?
No, because not even Gordie Howe would want to play enough to be the quarterback for the Carolina Panthers at that point. Look, it's proof positive, as Charlie Weiss said to me a couple years ago when I was researching a book on Tom Brady. There are 30 teams in the NFL. Each of them carry three quarterbacks. That's 90 guys. Of that 90 guys, about 22 of them can actually play the position. The fact that Vinny Testaverde is still a viable option, and he is a viable option, is proof positive of that statement.
Michael Vick began his prison sentence this week, which is a little bit weird since he hasn't been sentenced yet. Why is he in such a hurry?
I think he wants to get out as quickly as he can and revive what he perceives to be an NFL career, which I don't think is going to exist once he gets out. And hey, you know, better not to put off till tomorrow what you can do today.
Charlie, for years, I've had trouble understanding how college football's bowl championship series works. This season, the people in charge of the BCS have complicated the system's complications by changing the rules in the middle of the season. Is this something we need at this point?
I'm sorry, my brain had briefly turned to granite.
After I said BCS.
My fingernails and hair are getting longer.
Yes.
Yes, there are going to be 18 at-large candidates instead of 14 at-large candidates for the various BCS bowls. If I was running a college sports team and I knew I couldn't win the national championship, I just want to qualify for one of the Hawaii bowl games and just leave it at that. Why bother winning an extra game just so you can play in the Alamo Bowl?
On Tuesday, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that the state must disclose the salary of Penn State head coach Joe Paterno, among others, citing the public's right to that information. Will this be a blow to college football fiefdoms everywhere?
Well, I think it'll be a blow to college football fiefdoms or whoever comes after Joe Paterno, because I guarantee you, when this number gets revealed, it's a number that no other Penn State coach will ever attain.
A lot of football coaches have compared their game to war, Charlie, but would you agree that this week Alabama coach Nick Saban took that analogy to an exceptionally stupid level?
Exceptionally stupid, even by Nick Saban standards, which are considerable. Yes, he's pointing out that often changes don't happen until things get really bad. In other words, it's always darkest before the dawn. Instead, he pointed out that changes in history occur after some kind of catastrophic event and cited the 9/11 atrocities and the Pearl Harbor attack as the two relevant historical examples for which he has been justifiably pilloried. I don't know what they think about. I really don't. I know they're supposed to be focused. I know they're supposed to be concentrating only on their team. But what an ignoramus, even by football coach standards.
Yeah, the occasion was, of course, losing a game that probably his team should have won.
Well, yeah, they lost 21-14 to Louisiana Monroe. And Saban's contention is apparently that you have to hit rock bottom before you can start going up again. Here's a tip for you, Nick. Even if you don't want to dabble as the Arthur Schlesinger Jr. of the SEC, the University of Alabama is never supposed to lose to Louisiana Monroe.
To the surprise of few, Alex Rodriguez was named the American League's most valuable player this week, and that makes three MVP awards for him. How many more do you think he'll win before he retires?
Well, I think he's going to stay in New York, so he's going to have a voting block of writers behind him no matter what he does, as long as he stays at roughly the roughly the same level of accomplishment. Once again, another exhibit Q to the infinity for the proposition that sports writers should not be allowed to vote on these awards. Alex Rodriguez was not a unanimous choice for the American League MVP.
Remarkable.
Which is just stupid. I mean, that's Nick Saban stupid.
Charlie, last week you said you thought the most remarkable thing about the New York Knicks, given all the crime, punishment, and squabbling that franchise has been through,
said nothing.
Is that the team, and I'll bring the tape out if you insist, you said the team isn't
it's a
all
farrago
that bad.
Of untruth.
However, Knicks coach Isaiah Thomas was determined to prove you wrong, and by golly, he went right out and did
he's
it with seven straight
he's
losses.
He's lost seven in a row since I complimented his team. I will readily admit that the New York Knicks are a mess. But they're a talented mess. There are actual basketball players there. If they weren't owned by a lunatic and run by a sociopath, there would be a pretty good basketball team. Have I hedged my bets enough now?
You know, now he's going to have to go out and lose six more in a row so we can talk about this again. The NBA does not hold games on Thanksgiving Day. Why do you suppose the National Hockey League does?
Well, first of all, because it's not Thanksgiving in many of the outposts of the National Hockey League. Many of the outposts
Anaheim?
In the outposts of the National Hockey League had their Thanksgiving a few months ago. And the best game of the day, of course, was the 6-5 Pittsburgh win over Ottawa that went to the shootout, which is, I'm really sorry that the NHL is a minor league and doesn't have a national television contract, because I really would have liked to have watched that.
Charlie, hearts are heavy in England. The national soccer team lost to Croatia on Wednesday, a result that delighted the four Croats who are now driving new luxury cars around, courtesy of a Russian billionaire. I wonder what FIFA feels about incentives like these.
Well, there cannot possibly be a rule in place in FIFA involving bribery. I mean, it would be too much under-the-table laughter if that were the case.
It's right under the one involving flopping.
Exactly right. This is really tough for our brethren across the pond. They will not, I predict, the English national soccer team will not be in a BCS bowl this year.
And finally, Charlie, if there is a sudden increase in attendance at soccer games in Sweden, I guess the teams will have a particular group of Scandinavian campaigners to thank for that.
Now, I'm in a lot of trouble on this segment already, Bill, what with my Isaiah Thomas comments and so forth. Why are you giving me a story about Swedish women launching a campaign called Just Breasts, which fights for their right to go topless in beaches and swimming pools
and at soccer games?
And I was about to say to remove their tops in celebration at footy games the way the men do. Why are you handing me this? Isn't there a Russian billionaire who can bribe these women to not do this? Or do this or whatever?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine.
I'm in such trouble here.
And he joins me each week at this time, Trouble or Not, on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
That face, that face, that dangerous face. I mustn't be unwise. Those lips, that nose, those eyes could lead to my demise.
In his new book, The Agony of Victory, Steve Friedman explores the circumstances of various athletes who've overcome hardships to succeed, and others for whom success has been insufficient, and some who might have been better off if they'd never won anything at all. Steve Friedman joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. I'm a big fan.
Thank you. Marco Pantani, the cyclist who won the Tour de France and the Giro d'Italia, died in 2004 of a drug overdose, described the lengths to which his fans went to blame everybody but Pantani for the death of their champion.
Well, you said it. They blamed everybody but Pantani. It was the other cyclists. It was the International Cycling Federation. It was this sinister, shadowy conspiracy of people who didn't want an Italian to win the Tour de France. It was everyone. And listen, a lot of people did not like Pantani, and he was kind of a thorn in the side of the International Cycling Federation. So there's some truth to all that. But, you know, the guy was also, especially towards the end of his life, a drug addict and an alcoholic. Whereas a lot of these cyclists who are accused of blood doping, which he was, will eventually and at some point confronted with irrefutable evidence, will take their lumps, take a year or so off, accept the penalty, then come back. He just fought it, kept claiming he was innocent in the face of pretty overwhelming evidence that he was not. And I spent a lot of time in Italy and in Cuba, too, where he made his last trip. And it's no one wants to believe that. Everyone would much rather see him as this tragic hero, which he was in many ways. But they don't want to accept the fact that he had something to do with it, too.
One of the strangest stories in The Agony of Victory concerns former basketball star Marshall Rogers. When you visited with Rogers, he was taking his instructions from the Pope, among other sources, at least according to him, and blaming his problems on something that he called the animation machine. Did you ever come to understand what had happened to him and how it was connected to his success as an athlete?
I was just talking to someone yesterday about this. I think his athletic greatness, I mean, he was the leading scorer in Division I college basketball when his at Pan Am University. He'd gone to the University of Kansas first. But I think his athletic achievement occurred despite his problems. I had heard about, again, being from St. Louis, I'd heard about him growing up. He was this real success story from the inner city. And then I read an item after his career was over. I read an item in the Post-Dispatch that he'd been arrested for shoplifting and that he hadn't worked in a couple of years. He was living with his mother. And I thought, geez, what a story. What accounts for that decline? And so I got together with him and we hung out and we played basketball and visited his childhood haunts. And we were sitting at lunch one day and I asked if he had any children. And he said, oh, I had 5 children by 5 different women at Kansas, but the regime took care of them, got them all cars and money and houses and took care of them. And I thought, oh, the regime. I thought, here, my career is taken off now. This must be the athletic department and boosters and alumni clubs. And I thought, here's this Division I college program that has covered up for all this athlete's indiscretions as long as he could score 20 points a game. And then when he was of no use to them, they'd cast him aside. So I thought, I'm going to win a lot of journalism awards with this. And I said, oh, the regime. You mean the athletic department, the boosters? He said, no, the regime, Queen Elizabeth and King Arthur and the Pope. And, you know, it was horrifying. I remember being choked up because I saw, how profoundly mentally ill he was. And then a half second later, my reaction was, what a great story.
In the story titled Tough, you write about endurance athlete Danielle Ballingy, who, well, would it be accurate to say her agony came less from victory than from bad luck?
Yes, and her agony, it was external. It wasn't any internal stuff, although it became internal after a while. Yeah, and I would say, yeah, it came from just a slip. She's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, female endurance runner in the world. And she was out for a morning run near one of her homes. And for her, it was a nothing run. For me, it would probably kill me. But it was through the deserts, the high desert near Moab in Utah. She was with her dog. And she was climbing up. And, of course, she had mapped it out. She'd done it a few times. It involved clambering over some rocks and in these hidden valleys, places where no one else went. And she slipped. And she tumbled down what she described as a little wash. I went out and saw it. It was a cliff. It was a canyon. And she came to the bottom and she thought, I think I'm okay. I don't think I'm paralyzed. And she tried to stand up. She couldn't stand up. And she was almost paralyzed. Her pelvis had shattered. And her first thought was, well, it's going to take me a while to crawl out of here. She tried to crawl. She made it a quarter of a mile in 5 hours, and she had another 5 miles to go, and she realized she couldn't make it. And she was alone, and she was essentially bleeding to death. And she was there for 2.5 days, and as much as her career had been based on solitary achievement, what saved her was, and I still get a little choked up thinking about this, was her connection to others. Connections that I don't think she really realized until then were so strong, but that's what saved her. Not to give away the story too much, but I'd done a story years and years ago when I was a cub reporter on this animal called Jim the Wonder Dog.
Not to give away the story too much.
Yeah, well, Jim the Wonder Dog could read minds, tell the future, and communicate or understand 6 languages. Danielle's dog, Taz, makes Jim look like, what was the Jetsons dog? My dog, George, or whatever
Astro.
His name was. Astro.
I am ashamed of knowing that.
Makes Jim the Wonder Dog look like Astro, right. If you like dogs, you'll love this story.
This really is the story for the people who loved it when Lassie would show up and Mom or Dad would say, Timmy's fallen down a well? Where is the well, Lassie? Oh, over in the next county? Okay. And then they'd go rescue
him. Yeah. Taz could kick Lassie's butt. Yeah. Kids love this story. A lot of people have told me, oh, I read this with my child, right. With my 10-year-old. Yeah, Taz saves the day.
As you assembled the stories that make up the agony of victory, did you find that you had a favorite?
Probably my favorite is the story I did of my father and me, just because it meant so much to me personally. I'm also very fond of a story called The Unbearable Lightness of Being Scott Williamson, which is quite a mouthful. It's about a guy who devoted many years of his life to being the first person. He wanted to be the first person to hike the Pacific Crest Trail from Mexico to Canada and back in one try. No one had done it, and he took 5, 6, 7 years to do it. A lot of these stories are about the tension between isolation and human connectedness. And I think he just needed people so much. And it's really a love story about him and his best friend, and really just the terrible thing that happens and how that in some ways saves this guy. What he thought the solution was, which was isolation and wilderness, really turned out not to be the solution as much as people, as connection.
Steve Friedman is the author of The Agony of Victory, When Winning Isn't Enough, published by Arcade. He joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Steve, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thanks so much. It's been a real pleasure. I appreciate it.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Julian Soperiti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Ken Shulman's World Cup 2010 photo gallery or Milena Spitzer's flag football pictures or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from the turkey who enjoyed the 2007 presidential pardon. Oh, he must be at the Kansas-Missouri game, or worse. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities, on the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.